This week I'm joined once again by writer and occultist John Michael Greer. He has written multiple books on societal, economic and natural collapse, including The Long Descent, Dark Age America and Collapse Now and Avoid the Rush. In this special episode, we discuss COVID-19, the coronavirus, and its implications on the future. If you wish to support Hermetics Podcast, please find our donation, merchandise and Patreon links in the description below. Enjoy. John Michael Greer, thanks for coming on Hermetics for the fourth time for this sort of emergency pandemic special.
Well, thank you for having me on again. I always enjoy these shows.
Yeah. So the first thing I'm going to say here is I will allow you publicly to say I told you so to everyone listening. As a world-renowned societal collapse expert, I think it's deserved. But so yeah, we're in the midst of coronavirus, COVID-19, and I think I'm an avid reader of yours, and I'm an avid follower of Dmitry Orlov and James Kunstler and Chris Martinson. So just I hope it's not too arrogant to say this isn't what's happening here. Isn't too much of a surprise. Of course, a biological thing such as corona is not an anomaly, but you can't work it out. So we'll start here. What's it looking like where you are? You're in the small Appalachian mining town.
Actually, no. These days, I live in East Providence, Rhode Island. We've left the mountains and are now on the seacoast, but it amounts to much the same thing. East Providence is an old factory town. It's, of course, it's kind of a suburb of Providence itself, which is a smallish East Coast city. Mm-hmm. What it looks like here is kind of a slightly quieter version of business as usual. East Providence is not large enough to have a shelter-in-place order. They haven't locked down the city. They are, they've banned any large gatherings to get restaurant takeout food instead of sitting in. There are some other things that have shut down and so on in order to make sure that that the virus doesn't spread any faster than it has to. But the stores are still open and everything. So things seem to be going here as in most smaller communities in the United States. Everyone's just kind of taking it in stride.
Okay. So as someone who's written, I can't tally up the books. I know you've written 40 books on occultism and collapse. I'm not sure how many specifically on collapse, but you're a world-renowned, extremely prolific writer on collapse. And the many that I've read, I can't remember too many specific bits about, a biological thing such as this specifically, because I don't think that's your focus. Your focus is on the overarching ignorance, as far as I can see, of the assumptions we've made prior to these things happening. So as soon as this sort of began to spiral and it was clear that it wasn't SARS or MRSA again, and this is something that's sort of, I mean, if you think it is, something that's a bit larger than this, is this unfolding in a way that you anticipated?
Yes, and in fact, I did in a couple of my books and a number of blog posts, I discussed the likelihood that we would be seeing more pandemics, more major diseases, a general decline in public health. So this is totally predictable. It's simply normal when you have a community of any kind of living things. New microbes will get into the population at intervals. If anything, we're lucky. We have lucked out because this has a relatively mild death rate.
3 to 4%.
Depending on where you are,
Italy is 10%, I believe.
Yeah, we'll get into the complexities because there are some very interesting variations in death rates and a number of other factors going on here. But one way or another, it's not the Spanish flu. We're not looking at a 10 to 20% death rate. Mm-hmm. Much less, say, pneumonic plague. Mm-hmm. We could have gotten hit by something much harder. Now, the good side of that, well, I mean, other than the fact that a lot of people who might die in a more serious epidemic will get sick and then get better. The great thing about this is that we have a chance to see our vulnerabilities. We have a chance to realize, oops, we cannot rely on all of these systems remaining exactly in place. And so I've been hearing from a lot of folks, readers of mine and so on, who are going, oh, so this is what you're talking about. Gotcha. and it's great because, everyone has a chance to go through that period of disorientation, to let themselves be scared, to be aware of how vulnerable they are, how vulnerable the systems that, that support our daily lives are, and then we can do something about it. Mm-hmm. And so when the next crisis comes, and of course there will be a next crisis, when the next crisis comes, we'll be better prepared because it won't be striking us out of the blue. It will be, okay, here we go again. And that again is a very useful thing.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's interesting you say that because you're I'm not sure if you still identify as this politically, but you're a Burkean conservative, which is based...
I'm a moderate Burkean conservative,
which
is correct.
Which, as far as I understand it, is someone who says, we'll look at history and see if it worked. If it did, then we'll do it again. If it didn't, then either we tweak it or we don't do it. So
exactly.
So your hope here is that we learn from this, which, as far as I'm concerned, as the pessimist in me is concerned, we don't learn from history. So when you say, this will happen again, I'd like to think we'll mm-hmm. learn, but I just... Don't.
Well, the crucial thing here is who's doing the learning? Does humanity mm-hmm. as a whole learn the lessons of history? Of course not. There seems to be a law of intelligence in groups. The more people you put together, you like have to divide the average intelligence by the number of people in the group, or something mm-hmm. like that. Because mm-hmm. people in masses are dumber than rocks. Individuals can learn. Mm-hmm. And that's my hope, is that individuals looking at this will go, oh, okay, now I understand what that crazy Archdruid was talking about, and I won't be caught quite so cluelessly again the next time something like this happens. And that's the way any real change happens. It happens because individuals figure out something, and they get hit over the head by what the kids online these days call a clue by four often enough, and all of a sudden it's, oh, okay, and then they change their ways. That's what I'm hoping for. Will society as a whole, you know, wake up and get a clue? Of course not. Our species doesn't do that.
So I'm just going to go back to something you said there, because for some people that might not understand this, you have a background in ecology, mm-hmm. which mixed with a sort of, shall we say, esoteric reactionary nature, mixes into mm-hmm. sort of a hot pot of admitting things which people, even people in the hard sciences are now reluctant to admit because of certain things. Now, you said that it's sort of it is inevitable that mm-hmm. that bugs and viruses such as this will arise out mm-hmm. of large communities of animals, of species. Mm-hmm. In what way, in terms of ecology and nature as you understand it, is that an inevitability?
Okay. Basically, every living organism is constantly so to speak testing the edges of its habitat. There's always more people, or more viruses, or more chipmunks, or what have you. There are more critters than there is habitat, and so you always have this constant outward pressure, looking for some new way to make a living. And that's something you especially see in the world of microbes, where you have most of the life on this planet consists of single-celled organisms even today. Mm-hmm. And so there's vast numbers of them. They're constantly pressing on the boundaries of their habitats. They're looking for new things, new ways to get by, new opportunities to evolve and expand. And in the meantime, you also have the genetic processes that sort of keep the genome constantly shifting, constantly changing. And that's normal. That's what drives evolution. That combination of constant outward pressure, constantly changing genomes, and environmental constraints. And so because that's happening, at every moment, new organisms, new microbes, are evolving the different capacities, and by the simple luck of the draw, new microbes are going to figure out how to get into a very numerous species of organism that happens to be running around, namely us. We're food, as far as they're concerned. And so, you know, everyone's lining up at the restaurant, hoping to get some human takeout. and at regular intervals, they do so. I mean, we get a new flu virus every single year, and it is actually a different virus. The viruses change, they mm-hmm. mutate. That's why you have to get the doctors have different shots, not all of which work, for each season's flu, because it's always new. And in the same way, although over a longer time span, you constantly have new viruses that are, and new microbes of other kinds, that are pressing on the limits of their habitat and make the jump to human beings. And sometimes you have that, and it's something that kills people very quickly, like SARS, okay? So it can be shut down very, very rapidly, and you know who's sick. That's not a problem. In this case, a coronavirus, probably originally found in bats, was able to make the jump to human beings. Now, coronaviruses are very common among human beings. A lot of what causes the common cold are a set of coronaviruses that have long since been established in your nose and mine. Mm-hmm. And so this was a virus of a familiar type, a virus of a kind that does well with that sort of upper respiratory transmission. And so it got into the human, into the stock of human beings by way of apparently a meat market in Wuhan, China, and went, woohoo, I can do this. And so here it is. And the thing is, again, this kind of thing happens all the time. Every few years, we have a new virus coming into circulation, even leaving aside like flu virus and so on. But every few years, we have a novel virus that finds some way into the human population. And maybe it kills a few people, and maybe it kills a lot of people, and maybe it just makes some people ill. It depends on the luck of the genetic draw. But it's a constant process. It's something that has always gone on, and presumably always will go on.
Mm-hmm. Now, it's interesting that you brought up the key factors of, I think, why this is scaring people. Now, as far as I can see it, something we've spoken about before, as far as I can see it, the actual reason that this is sort of terrifying to people isn't actually to do with the economic collapse, isn't to do with instability or this uncertainty that they're having. It's actually what people are beginning to see, what is being revealed by these processes, which is death and illness are still real, even though they're covered, even though they're one of the primary functions of society as a whole is to force the idea that these things no longer happen, they no longer exist. Painkillers for pain, death is hidden away, you know, you have no worries, comfort time all the time. And this coronavirus, this mortality rate of just 3% is this sort of stoic, cynical, cosmic reminder, you know, you can die, you are not invulnerable.
Not only can you die, you will die. And, you know, nobody lives forever. This is the great lie of our society, and you see this in the medical profession so often. Well, you know, we can keep people from dying of this, and we can keep people from dying of that, we can keep people from dying of the other. Well, what do you want them to die of? Because they're going to die. We all, you know, none of us lives forever. And so, yeah, this is a very useful reminder of the fact that we have a temporary lease on life in this world, and when it's up, it's up. And of course, that's freaking people out because, again, as you mentioned, people like to pretend otherwise. They love to believe that it doesn't matter, it can't happen. So yeah, that's one of the major things that's scaring people. Also, though, there's simply the fact that this, unlike some illnesses, this one transmits very well without you knowing it. Mm-hmm. People can be dripping viruses from every pore and look perfectly healthy. Mm-hmm. And so that's producing the sort of terror reaction. And it's also revealing things like some of the limitations on our economic system, not in terms of economic collapse, but in terms of, say, toilet paper.
Mm-hmm. Well, this was one of the key things I've got written down here, because the toilet paper is an interesting one. As I understand it, the two facts I've got on this is either, let's just not beat around the bush here, either diarrhea isn't really a symptom of this bug, or only 10% of people get it, which to me means the toilet paper thing brings to the fore one of the key sort of problems and mentalities of the day, which is mimicry or mimetics or sort of copying or herd think. Because ultimately, no one needs the toilet paper. There is enough to go around, but no one actually needs it for the purposes they're buying it. What happened was one person bought it, and, you know. So this is what is, as far as I can see, fueling the panic, which is just mimicry.
Mimicry, and then the awkward reality that if you don't join the panic, you might not be you may run out of toilet paper.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So you have it becomes kind of a prisoner's dilemma. Do you join the panic and feed it, or do you sit back and go, I don't care, and then you have to like find some other way to clean yourself after you use the toilet. So, I mean, for that was why. I mean, we didn't go whole hog, but I did pick up a couple of extra packages, and the stores, the local stores, are fairly short on toilet paper at this point.
Yeah, we're fairly short, but I did the same thing. But you know, I don't want to put myself outside of the herd, because I did exactly what I believe most people are doing. I believe there's, let's say if there's 100 people, there's only 3 or 4 who are actually panic buying. The problem is there's another 20 in the store who see that. And like you said, it's sort of a status thing. You know, you don't want to get caught out. You don't want to be the one who doesn't get it. But
exactly.
This does bring me through to another thing. And this might be a lot of people's introduction to your work, you know, a world collapse expert on a current collapse. So it brings me through to the mentality of prepping and stockpiling.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, people, we've spoken before about this, and you've always, the practical advice of people always ask, how many cans of gherkins do I need to buy? And then, you know, well, how many do you normally eat? None, right? You need none. And when I go to the stores, I see the shelves that are run out, a lot of the ones I expected, but also a lot of strange ones. Pasta sauce, microwavable rice, things which are just very odd to me. Now, what do you make of this sort of strange, sudden prepping mentality?
It is really odd. It is really odd, because I think to some extent the prepper movement has been successful in getting the idea out into circulation that one of the things you can that will help you weather the ordinary ups and downs of life is a cupboard or two full of food.
Mm-hmm.
And of course they're quite right, but of course then people get panicky. They don't necessarily think clearly. Here, for example, one of the grocery stores where I routinely shop, all of the containers of broth. There's this shelf of various soup broth. Okay, people just cleaned it out.
Mm-hmm.
I have no idea why. But things will happen that way. Again, it is herd think. One of the things this is very usefully reminding us is that we are not really rational beings. I mean, most of us under some circumstances, when we're calm and not particularly threatened by anything, we can think rationally.
Mm-hmm.
But it doesn't come naturally. It's not something that happens automatically. And you put any pressure on most people, and the rational mind just shuts down, and they do some very strange things, like running around buying microwavable rice or something like that. So I think that's a lot of it. One good thing that could come of this is that people may, after the whole thing is over, take a look at what they bought. Say, what am I going to do with all those cans of gherkins? and think about putting by a stash of things they actually eat.
Mm-hmm.
You know, filling up a cupboard and rotating in and out, and just having that little bit of cushion to keep them going when the next crisis shows up.
Mm-hmm. Now, of course, this is, as far as I can see, entering us, I hope, you know, like we said, I hope that individuals will learn from this. I hope people will learn from this. Of course, as you've mentioned, the herd doesn't learn as a herd. It's now, there is a few things I've jotted down here that I believe, hopefully, I mean, perhaps this is my own biases coming out here, but hopefully I believe will be increased or decreased. And one of the ones is actually a sort of less reliance or a inherent distrust of mega business, of supermarkets, mm-hmm. of understanding that, because as far as I can see, a lot of people, you know, we're taught in schools, always be thankful that water comes out of the tap and there's food on the shelves. And I don't believe we're actually taught that anymore. And I think for most people, food in the stores is almost a right. It's a thing. Mm-hmm. It's a thing which is, in the same way that you plant an acorn, a tree grows. You know, it's something that is a fact of living in the West. There is food in the shops, and mm-hmm. this is sort of, Corona has fractured the the dream.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It's making people actually aware that they do need to think about where their food comes from. Over on this side of the pond, I've heard from a number of people who are involved in small farms and things like that, and it's really rather funny because they've been getting panicked calls from people sometimes from some distance away who want to know if they, you know, what are they growing? What do they have? What kind of food do they have? It's March. Come on. In some areas, the seeds have just gone into the ground. In some areas, it's still too cold. So, you know, you don't... there's some learning that has to happen here, no question. But yeah, people are beginning to become aware that they can't simply assume that these megastructures of everyday life are going to function as expected. And that's very important. Once people get to the point of grasping the fragility of our existing systems, it becomes much easier to do things to make those systems less fragile, to promote local reliance rather than the sort of global megastructure that we're stuck with at the moment, and so on.
Mm-hmm. Where do you think those assumptions come from?
The advertising.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody ever turned on the television and saw an advertisement of with bare shelves saying, "We'll have more food in next week." So it's advertising on the one hand, and also, since the Second World War, the industrial world, the Western world, has had an extraordinary and historically very unusual period of stability and peace and prosperity. We've had economic downturns, sure, but compared to what has happened in the past, they've hardly been noticeable.
Mm-hmm.
And we haven't had, you know, since the Second World War, we haven't had to deal with food rationing, we haven't had to deal with real shortages, we haven't had to deal with bombs dropping out of the sky or any of the other charming things that history is generally full of. Well, not necessarily bombs dropping out of the sky, but enemy horsemen stampeding through the gates works out of the same thing. So basically, we've gotten lazy.
Mm-hmm.
We've gotten comfortable and cozy and, you know, thinking that everything's fine and nothing can really change. Francis Fukuyama, who is a source of endless amusement to me, he's an American intellectual who some years ago wrote a book announcing that history was over. Okay, history's done with... The end of history. The end of history, because the whole point of history. You know, this is Hegel, and we can get to that in a bit. But the whole point of history is this sort of competition between governmental systems to determine which one is best. And with the defeat of the Soviet Union and the triumph of what we laughingly call liberal democracy, that is settled once and for all. There may be events, but everything is going to settle down into this nice, calm, stable afternoon where nothing much happens ever again.
A lovely thesis.
It's perfect Hegel, which means I don't know if you've ever read Hegel's Philosophy of History.
Unfortunately, I always diverted at Schopenhauer, and my favorite quote on Hegel is from the philosopher Nick Land, which is, "Reading Hegel is brain cancer," which is one of my...
I will not argue.
If we're talking, you know, for anyone who's not philosophy savvy, antithesis, thesis, and then a synthesis. So an agreement, a disagreement, and then we have come to a compromise. Now, unfortunately, I think perhaps you'd agree with me here, John, coronavirus isn't part of that threefold structure. It's the
exactly.
It's the diagonal, which it's history, you know, you're not immune to history. It's history coming back.
Exactly. Yeah, the problem with Hegel's theory of history always produces nonsense. Apply it to the real world, no matter whether you do it from the far left, from the far right, from in between, like Francis Fukuyama, if you apply Hegel to history, you get complete gibberish. I know of no system of thought less likely to give you correct answers. And so... And this is a great example. This whole notion that history is this process whereby something unfolds in time and then settles down to a nice stable situation and squats there. No, that doesn't happen. It didn't. It, you know, Hegel himself thought that, I forget the exact nature of it, but he was convinced that history was about to come to an end in his time or shortly thereafter. He was wrong. Everyone else who's thought that way has been wrong, too. Yeah, the coronavirus is not a thesis. It's not an antithesis. It will seek no synthesis. It's simply, I have now forgotten who described history as just one damn thing after another. And that's what coronavirus is, another damn thing.
Yeah, yeah. I guess what comes to mind to me is the sort of atomist reading of history. You know, if you have the lamina plane of everything's flowing straight, everything's going fine, and then you have the Kliniman or the Kleinman, which is just that one deviation. And, you know, to put it in sort of horrible materialist terms and scientific terms, which I don't like to do, but all you have to think is that one atom at some point moved within a version of coronavirus, one atom moved in this bat, and someone ate that, and, you know, there was just this tiny, tiny thing, and now it's spiraled into this absolute chaos.
And now we have a world-class mess to deal with. Yeah, exactly.
A world-class mess which is sort of positive-oriented as well. It's sort of feeding itself, unfortunately. And I think... you know, this was going to come much later, but we talk about, you know, the end of history. I'm sort of reminded of, you know, not to keep throwing in... But I do want to throw in another philosopher who's just not Hegel, which is Nietzsche, which is, you know, cyclic. History comes back and bites you in the ass, you know.
Nietzsche would have been delighted with that description of his philosophy, yes.
I'd like to think so. You know, we're talking about things which are happening again, and perhaps you can shed a bit more light on this than me, but the wage injection idea which we're having in the UK, we're going to pay 80% of laid off workers' wages, or workers who are going to get laid off, we're going to pay 80% of their wages for 3 months, maybe more. This to me is pure Keynes. This is 1930 all over again.
Of course it is.
I mean, perhaps you can probably articulate it better than me. I can, but you know, why won't this work?
Well, the question is, what is it trying to do? When you say, will it work, it depends on what... The point is, they're trying to buy votes, of course. Here in the United States, we're looking at every adult American receiving two checks, each of them for $1,000, just for the privilege of existing. And so, and again, it's a very effective way to buy votes. You want to make people feel like the government is taking care of you, they care about you, da 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 da. And since money at this point is basically a collective fiction, coming up with the umpty billion dollars necessary to, or the umpty billion pounds necessary for the scheme over on your side of the pond, is child's play. You just tell the computer it has more money. Now, the question is, what is going to happen when that hits? We don't know yet. The experiment has not been run. And these days, I am sufficiently suspicious of all economists of every persuasion. When you realize how few economists actually make accurate predictions, you are much better off going to an astrologer. Astrologers will not tell you that the sun will rise in the west. Economists say the equivalent all the time. So I don't know what's going to happen when that money starts splashing into the economy. I also don't know what's going to happen. You know, one of the major variables here is how long is the epidemic going to continue? Mm-hmm. If it's a very short-term thing, we'll go through. There will doubtless be some amount of you know, convulsions around the sudden jolt of money in the economy. If it becomes a long-term thing, that can become rather more complex. But I don't know what's going to happen as a result.
Yeah, there was a joke that you and Dmitry Orlov, or you and James Kunstler, used to love to tell, which is, I can't remember how it goes. I believe it's, what do you call an economist
what do you call an economist who makes a prediction?
I don't know.
The answer is wrong.
Classic.
back in 2005, 2006, 2007, when we had one of the world's classic speculative bubbles in real estate over here, and I think generally also, and it had big signs saying, "Hi, I'm a speculative bubble," all over it. Every single box was checked, and all of the economists were saying, no, this is a perfectly reasonable increase in values. And everybody outside the economics, well, not everybody, but a significant number of people outside the economics profession were going down point by point and showing, no, this is a bubble, it's going to blow big time, probably in 2008. as indeed it did.
Yeah.
And so there were entire blogs. A guy named Keith Brand, I think it was, had a great blog called Housing Panic. Mm-hmm. And his tagline was, "Dear God, this is going to end so badly." And he was right. And yet the economists, the people who in theory should have been first to go, "That has all the signs of a speculative bubble," they were completely clueless. They literally, they could not have been more wrong if they had set out with that goal. And so, yeah, what do you call an economist who makes a prediction? Wrong. It works.
And for anyone who sort of wants to watch or read about that housing bubble in real time, the book The Big Short and the film The Big Short are both fantastic on it. And there's a brilliant scene in the film which actually, I think, articulates what we're talking about in terms of assumptions extremely well. And Michael Burry walks into a sort of a housing estate financier's banking office with the big heads and says, "You know, I want to short the housing market." And they're trying to smirk while he says, "You know, I want $2 billion to short the housing market." And as he walks out, they're sort of belly laughing, bending over, and because it's impossible to, you know, you still hear people now saying, "Well, if I came into loads of money, I'd put it into property. Property's always good. It's an investment." Now, an investment is something that should grow or should have intrinsic value, as I understand it.
Exactly.
So unless there's water on your land, you haven't got an investment. You've got a piece of property. And an American suburban property especially is less than useless.
Exactly. It was the whole thing was so crazy. Actually, the other thing that I would recommend our listeners check out is the best book ever written on economic bubble and pop, which is The Great Crash 1929 by John Kenneth Galbraith. It is the funniest, most gripping, most hilarious, most side-splitting work of serious economic history you'll ever encounter. And once you read it and think about it, you will never be fooled by a speculative bubble again, because they all look the same. And people act the same way, and they even trot out the same slogans.
What are the key late telltale signs which you believe should be so obvious?
Oh yeah, no, the flashing red light that means get your money out, stick it under the mattress if you must, is the insistence that not only will the asset class that's at the center of the bubble continue going up forever, but it will continue going up so far and fast that if you don't get in now, you're going to miss out on becoming rich.
Mm-hmm.
Once you start getting the moment people, a significant number of people start saying, you know, there's unlimited upside for this, this will only always go up, flee.
Yeah.
And once they start saying, you better get in now, it's going to crash shortly. There was a book published by, I forget the guy's name now, on the who was in the National Association of Realtors, I think it was. And it was all about how you have to get into real estate now or you're going to miss out completely. You'll never be able to own your own house, blah, blah, blah. And I think it came out about 3 weeks before the bottom fell out. Now, I have some. There's good historical parallels here, because you have probably heard of an American family from Massachusetts named the Kennedys.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Uh-huh. The reason you have heard about the Kennedys is that old Joe Kennedy, who was, well, let's be polite, he was a member of the Irish criminal underworld. Basically, he made his money as a rum runner, but he had made enough money that he had money in stocks and things like that. And in, I think it was 26, 27, something like that, he was getting his shoes shined by a shoeshine boy on Wall Street. And the shoeshine boy offered him a stock tip. Mm-hmm. And old Joe Kennedy thought about that and said, if shoeshine boys are starting to get into the stock market, it is time to get out. He pulled all of his money out of the market that day and stuck it in nice, stable, unexciting investments totally unrelated to the subject. And so when the market crashed in 1929, he did not lose one red cent. And all of a sudden, old Joe Kennedy was one of the richest men in America, not because he had made all that much money, but because he hadn't lost it all.
Yeah. And it's sort of along the lines of the Warren Buffett saying, you know, when there's blood in the streets, that's when you should buy. When everyone else is saying buy, 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 the chance is already too late. You haven't.
Oh yeah.
You haven't found it.
Yeah, and the thing is, remember that whatever you are hearing is promotion.
Yeah.
It's not whatever you hear from a pundit is not in your best interest. They're treating you are the sucker, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And so if you do whatever they're trying to get you not to do, when they're saying you've got to get into the market, that means you need to get out of the market. When they're going, when they're desperately piling out of the market and saying, "Oh my God, it's going to go down and down and down," then you want to look at good values to buy. Because, you know, they're trying to play you for a fool. You don't have to cooperate.
Yeah. If you can't spot the sucker at a poker table, you are the sucker.
Yes, very much so.
But it brings to the fore another thing which coronavirus is actually revealing, which is what it's done is it's stripped us back to a lesser extent, not sort of John Zerzan primitivist run to the woods survival, but the things which are still running stably I find it humorous that if you look at, say, Italy, we're on total lockdown, they're saying you can go to the pharmacy, you can go to the hospital, doctors, you can go to the shop, and you can go at home. Now, that's shelter, food, and health. Mm-hmm. You know, these mm-hmm. are your survival basics. And mm-hmm. when we're talking about there with houses, we're talking about value. And you suddenly, something like this cuts through, you know, all the crap, and you go, here's what has actual mm-hmm. value.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I think this is one of the reasons why I think that the aftermath of this whole fandango may actually turn out to be very good for at least those of us who survive, mm-hmm. because this is a real opportunity to check, okay, what actually matters.
Mm-hmm.
Most people in industrial society today spend most of their time on stuff that does not matter diddly squat. It doesn't even matter to them. They're doing it because it's fashionable. They're doing it because the media tells them to. They're doing it because it's a habit. They're doing it because they simply didn't think enough not to. But now all of a sudden, there's a lot of people who are sitting at home. And these various occupations that have filled their days and nights are close to them. And I've been hearing people, on the one hand, people saying, wow, it's so quiet and so pleasant, and I'm actually feeling so relaxed.
Yeah.
Which, I mean, the doom of whole sectors of the consumer economy is written in those words. But I'm also hearing from people who are really stopping and thinking and saying, okay, when this is over, what do I actually want to do? Mm-hmm. So again, individuals, the herd will continue stampeding off the cliff, which is the basic shape of human history. But individuals can learn. Individuals can wake up, look at what they're doing, look at the way they're living their lives, and decide if they really want to go back to doing the particular round they were doing in the past.
Mm-hmm.
So there can be advantages to this kind of thing. I knew some people, this is a few years ago, of course, I knew some people who well remembered life during the Second World War when you had a lot of rationing. Here, of course, we didn't have bombs falling, but there was a lot of rationing. There were a lot of things you simply could not get. There were a lot of limitations that mm-hmm. people had to deal with. And everyone I knew who went through that said, you know, we actually learned a whole lot by going through that experience.
Mm-hmm.
It actually, you know, when the war was over and the troops came home and we finished partying and finished drinking ourselves blind drunk to celebrate the defeat of the Axis, things were different for a while. People were a little less prone to do certain kinds of stupid things. So I have hopes that this might help at least for a little while.
This actually reminds me of a section from, I'm sure you've read it, and I don't think I've seen you comment on him, which is strange, and I've always wondered about this, but it reminds me of a section from Industrial Society and Its Future by Kaczynski. I'm assuming you have read this.
Actually, I have not. That does not ring any bells. So tell me about this book.
Ted Kaczynski, the
Unabomber.
Yeah.
Yes. Oh, yeah. The essay. Okay. I'm sorry. Yes. Yes, I have read that. Although it's been a while.
Mm-hmm. So, just gonna say, I don't obviously don't agree with what he did, but the manifesto itself, which is sort of an anti-tech, pro-Luddite. Mm-hmm.
essay for anyone who doesn't know. It's interesting, it is well written. He was a smart guy, but he also was a sociopath and a terrorist and a murderer. But anyway, there is a point in it where he begins to discuss what we're discussing here, which is surrogate activities. And once you remove survival, you know, when a human is without the, shall we say, the life support system of modernity for its meaning, you know, when your day is starting, you go, well, if I don't do this, I won't have food and I will die. There is no question of the meaning of your existence. But once those things are literally spoon fed to you, and I've said this before, that in many Western countries, you could literally lay down and do nothing and you still wouldn't die, because you'd be picked up and taken somewhere where they would not allow you to die. You know, your survival is, you are an infant. So once all your survival, your food, your water, your shelter is all catered for, Kaczynski makes this point of saying, well, you begin to put your meaning onto surrogate activities. Now, what Corona has done is removed this sort of veil, and you go, well, here's this, you know, you can now see the crap that I've been finding meaning in. Yeah, I don't know what you'd make of that.
Yeah, no, I think that one of the irritating things about a certain class of social critics is that they're really good at explaining what's wrong with the current system and really bad about suggesting what to do about it. Kaczynski is a great example.
Yeah.
Some of the points he made in his manifesto are actually quite good, but his approach to dealing with it is crazed, to put it lightly.
Yeah, I agree.
But, yeah, the it's when people don't have to deal with realities, with the reality of being fed, with the reality of, you know, the making life for themselves, that, yeah, they redirect everything toward these surrogate activities. And many of these activities are, to any outside view, really rather strange, which is fine. I mean, we're like most social primates, we're rather creative, and we do funny things. But there's also, of course, the fact that we've got an entire economy, the entire consumer sector of the economy depends on making people take on new surrogates and pay for the privilege.
Mm-hmm.
So you have people who invest their identity in a sports team. And of course, they have to pay this and buy that, and so on and so forth. Or they invest their identity in this, you know, some kind of internet activity, or in a movie star, or in all of these bizarre things. And there's a lot of propaganda. There's a lot of manipulative stuff that's intended to encourage people to waste their lives that way, because that's very profitable for the industries that benefit from it. And here again, the current situation is making that there's that gap now. I mean, in some cases, people could still go online and play World of Warcraft or whatever it is, but a lot of those surrogate activities have been shut down. Nobody's going to you know, sports games at this point. And bit by bit, I think it's starting to sink in that for some people that, well, maybe that wasn't all that it was cracked up to be.
Mm-hmm. Sort of the small cartoon I've seen online before, which says it's a picture of two people just kind of farming a small allotment, and it says and one of them is saying yeah, we've got everything we need, and we're very content and happy, and below it just says capitalism's worst enemy.
yes, very much so. Yeah, and the thing is, it is not necessary for an economy to work that way. We've managed to create one collectively that does, and of course it's very poorly suited to the era of economic contraction that we're moving deeper into at this point. And so I think one of the things that one of the great tasks we face is figuring out how to meet our economic needs in a way that doesn't provide so much room for so many sources of distractions, so many sources of so many ways that people can manipulate us to soak up our money and pretend that they're giving us meaning in return.
Mm-hmm. It's sort of put very very articulately the other day. Someone said that the economy doesn't produce the thing you desire; it produces the desire itself. And it's sort of like we discussed, I believe in the first interview, about the dancing Santa Claus you get at Christmas. Spend 10 seconds thinking about the things you're doing, why you're doing, where that desire came from, and you usually can never find an origin.
Yeah, because you're not looking in the right place, because the origin is not in you. The desire is being created in you by an advertising campaign. And so, yeah, here we start getting into, I mean, it's really difficult to talk about this sort of thing without using terms like sorcery, without using terms like spell and trance. And Ioan Coleanu, the brilliant Romanian-American scholar who wrote Eros and Magic in the Renaissance some decades back, he was very clear on this. He points out that modern advertising is a debased form of magic. It's a way of, to borrow Dion Fortune's definition of magic, causing change in consciences in accordance with will. Of course, your consciousness is being changed, but it's not your will that's changing. It's the guy who's paying for the ad. So one of the things that all of this points to is the need for us to decolonize our own imaginations, to take our imaginations, our minds, our thoughts, our feelings, and take control over them, and instead of leaving them in the hands of a bunch of advertisers.
Mm-hmm. And I think anyone who's, which I imagine, you know, unfortunately, a lot of people are going to be, anyone who's not sympathetic to the occult or magic framework of this, is, you can put it in materialist terms of, I think it was David Foster Wallace who said that an advert creates an anxiety which is relievable by purchase. And what you need to do is assess, what are you anxious about? Is it because you don't, you know, I'm not going to have this fast car. Are you anxious that, you know, you're not going to have the status? Well, why do you want the status? And then you'll answer that and you go, well, why do you feel like you need that, et cetera, et cetera. And eventually you get to the point that, no, so this is all sort of free floating and is held together by its own justification.
Yeah, and you can take it the other way and go, well, will buying this product actually give what, you know, provide the service that it's supposed to? And the answer is always no.
No.
Because a satisfied customer doesn't keep shopping. And so if you look, you know, here we have a beer ad, okay? And there's I don't know what your beer ads are like over here, over there. Over here, your typical beer ad has a bunch of people having a mix, men and women together, of course. And the women are always, at least one of the women is looking adoringly at one of the men. It's really quite tacky. But you know, they're raising glasses of beer, and they're all fashionable, and they're all young, and they're all pretty. And look at that with a jaundiced eye as it sits there on the billboard and go, for real? No.
No.
No. You are not going to experience this by buying buying a bottle of cheap yellow beer, because it's almost always the cheap yellow beer that's being advertised that way. You know, this you are not going to have that experience. You're going to sit there and drink this fizzy yellow substance that you know, you just want to speculate what creature's bladder produced it if you want to, but you know, you're going to sit there drinking this stuff, and you're going to have exactly the same kind of social life that you had when you weren't drinking this stuff. There this cheap yellow beer is not a magic talisman that will make you young and pretty and fashionable and get girls to gaze at you adoringly. And once you start looking at ads that way and taking them apart and saying, okay, what manipulation is that one trying? It becomes kind of funny.
Mm-hmm. But then once you begin to draw that back to, you know, as far back as you can go with that, you begin to question, well, why did I ever need, let's say, the desire for some form of social status in the first place? And that's when I believe you begin to target yourself towards a more very troubled word, but authentic form of self. But one thing I would just comment there is the consumer has become sort of sadomasochistic, because a lot of advertising now is sort of kitchen sink realism and ironic, and it would sort of actually give you the brutal, you know, reality of what it's actually like. And but instead of consumers feeling that they're mocked, they'll sort of laugh and say, "Oh, that's, you know, that's me. That's what I do." And I think to that extent that a sort of, you know, the modern beer ad, and we don't have too many in this country now, but I think the modern beer ad, you know, should be a sort of balding, middle-aged phone salesman on a Saturday night, sat on his own, just watching mm-hmm. soaps. And I think, you know, perhaps that would still yeah. sell, unfortunately. I think it was Lyotard who said that the working class love the pain and strife of working. They, you know, they adore it. They sort of they revel in the idea that they're suffering, I think. Not sure I agree, but there you go.
I'm not sure he's right. I think I sometimes suspect that he didn't spend a lot of time talking to working class people.
You suspect that upper middle class French philosopher didn't spend much time with the working class?
Exactly. I don't think he spent enough time in working class bars or the equivalent, just listening to the talk and of course that's the pervasive problem with a lot of the leftward end of politics. They're full of talk about the sufferings of the working poor and all this kind of stuff, and it's all written by people who have never skipped a meal in their lives and who are the beneficiaries of the system that they claim to be opposed to. And of course that, you end up with all kinds of strange paradoxes coming out of that.
And it's sort of the etiquette, the cleanliness, and the professionalism of the left, which mm-hmm. always bemuses me in terms of, you know, I grew up around a lot of working class mm-hmm. people, and I don't want, you know, these are people I get on with, so, and I know that their humour is one of pure banter and self-depreciation. Mm-hmm. So they wouldn't mm-hmm. mind me saying this. But the stereotypes are true. And mm-hmm. when you hear a left-wing sort of... I'm thinking of Owen Jones in the UK, talk about supporting the working class. I just want to say to him, you need to walk into a sort of rural town drinker's boozer on a Saturday night around 11 p.m. and see if these are the people talking about Marxist labour, you know, labour value and species being, you know, mention that to them, and either you're going to get chucked out or you're going to get knocked out, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It's ridiculous.
It's ridiculous, but it's a source of great amusement, and it's also unfortunately a source of severe vulnerability to the left, because what we've seen here in the United States in the era of Trump, is that Trump is actually addressing the working class, talking about the issues that concern the working class, and doing a fairly good job of winning support from that source. Whereas the left is now sort of flailing because the working class is supposed to follow us, and so you have all of these clean-cut corporate airbrushed, you know, middle management types who are doing studies to try to explain the bizarre fact that when Trump says something that offends the comfortable and privileged, the working class aren't offended.
Mm-hmm.
During the run up to the 2016 election, there was this amazingly funny situation. They did this study with a bunch of Trump voters. They got a bunch of Trump voters and they showed them a video, an advertisement that was meant to convince them not to vote for Trump.
Mm-hmm.
And they tested him before and afterwards on their approval on what they thought of Trump. And nearly every one of them, after watching this video, was even more strong in their support of Trump. And all of the talking heads were going, this is just totally bizarre. Is it some kind of weird mental problem? Well, no. The video was made by corporate, by upper middle class talking heads, mm-hmm. for upper middle class talking mm-hmm. heads, talking in the same terms that the working class has had to deal with for all these years. They know you're lying.
Yeah, yeah.
Your lips are moving.
And it, yeah. And if I know the word...
So,
oh, sorry.
Yeah. No, and so... But it still goes... The people in the suits cannot apparently grasp the fact that an enormous number of working class Americans see through them,
mm-hmm.
don't believe what they say, distrust them, recognize that they're speaking out of class privilege, not out of their great, you know, their much vaunted sympathy for the working class and blah, 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 blah. So it's been hilarious to watch.
Well, this is the whole thing
cracks down the middle.
Well, this was your comments on Brexit as well, which I sort of can condense down to, in my opinion here, that everything that is wrong as far as the left see it, isn't the sincere and genuine opinion of the person who voted. It's a fault in their thinking. You know, no, everyone on the left, anyone who votes conservative in the UK, to people on the left, that isn't their sincere opinion. They don't actually believe Jacob Rees-Mogg or Boris Johnson. That's a fault in their thinking which needs to be fixed. Same with Brexit. And of course, their tactic to when you said, well, I'm a Leaver or a Brexiteer, was you're a fascist and a bigot. And all that did was make those voters go silent. But unfortunately, when you're inside the voting booth, you no longer have to be silent. And that was the first... Exactly. I'm in complete agreement with you. I've listened to your interview. That was the first truly working class vote that has ever happened in the UK since about the late 80s.
Yeah, and just watching the run-up to the Brexit vote, it was very parallel to watching the run-up to Trump's election in 2016. Mm-hmm. All of the pundits trotting out a set of canned talking points that were completely detached from the reality that most people lived in. And they were. It was all focused within an echo chamber, within an echo chamber of comfort and privilege, and nobody addressed the concerns of the majority of the voters. It was frankly eerie, and then when the Brexit vote went the way it did, the constant, well, that can't have happened. Well, we have to do it again. Maybe they'll get it right this time. The total unwillingness to grasp the fact that a great many million British subjects looked at what was being offered them and said, no, we want our country back, and had good reasons to do so. And the fact that they're still not getting it. And, of course, that's why Johnson was able to stomp the opposition in this last election you had. Everyone else was talking about the stuff that appealed within their echo chambers. Johnson took things straight to the voters, straight to the working class voters, and knew perfectly well that if he did so, he could break the red wall in the Midlands and the North, as indeed he did, and overturn the established certainties of British politics. And I don't think the Labour has yet grasped what happened.
No, they haven't. Labour aren't Labour in terms of what that name actually historically means. They're an affluent liberal sort of university party. And people vote for them for the sake of every policy we have is targeted at good cause or some virtue, or instead of well, who's going to fix the potholes? Who's going to these things aren't addressed anymore. That's the frustrations for the working class.
Yeah, exactly. And so, to the extent that the Conservatives can reorient themselves to become a party that has something to offer the working class, Labour may find itself out in the cold for a good long time. In the same way, we're facing a similar shift here, although it's a rather more ragged process. We don't have the neatly ordered structure of parliamentary government. We have a more ramshackle structure, but it's happening here as well. As the sort of working class populism takes off and aligns around Trump and his various supporters, there's a real sea change going on here, and a lot of the old line Democrats who assume as a matter of course that, for example, African American voters will necessarily vote Democrat, are facing a shattering surprise.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's a fantastic article by Curtis Yarvin, which is sort of in short, saying that, back to coronavirus, that coronavirus is probably the kind of the first death blow in many to globalism. Now, and what it's doing, prior to this, we had 4 years of the beginnings of nationalism again. We had Trump, Le Pen gaining support, AfD in Germany gaining support, Bolsonaro in Brazil, to a lesser extent, Farage, Mogg, and Johnson in the UK. And a few more elsewhere. I believe Italy as well was going towards the nationalist thing, and you're seeing what the left at least consider right wing parties bring up. But the interesting thing, which I think Corona has brought along, and this is sort of a dark joke, is that it's ramped up the need for borders and immigration checks and sort of said, look, globalism isn't really working and there's other reasons for that which are now coming out of the woodwork. It's making us swallow a lot of truths which we just didn't want to admit because we had this amazing system. So it's ramping up nationalism, but at the same time, it's promoting really aggressive socialist economic strategies. And someone made the dark joke of saying, unfortunately, history does have a compromise for you there.
Yes, and that's that. I'm sure that will be on many people's minds. The thing to keep in mind is that that particular compromise party, with its armbands and jackboots, was not the first to call itself National Socialist. There were National
People
Socialist
always forget
parties.
As well. People always forget. They get called fascists, but, you know.
Yeah, exactly. There were National Socialist parties in several European countries by 1900. It was a known known attitude within the range of possibilities, and the fact that Hitler happened to take that moniker as in his attempt to kind of take over the excluded middle in German politics in the 1920s and 1930s is kind of unfortunate because it's made it difficult to talk about the way that many countries actually have gone toward a sort of mixed economy, where you have, on the one hand, a lot of economic activity left to the free market. On the other hand, a lot of government regulation and social safety net measures, which is more or less what that combination comes down to.
Yeah. So, as Orlov says, socialism with market elements, you know.
A market economy with socialist elements.
Yeah, either way.
So exactly. And the thing is that sort of mixed economy, it irritates the stuffing out of economists, which is a good thing right there. And it also causes a lot of irate feelings among the more ideologically minded on all sides, because it's not pure this and it's not pure that and it's not pure the other thing. But it works better than many of the alternatives. And so, especially in times of crisis, I mean, look at what happened during, again, the Second World War is a great example. In Britain, in America, in every country, every serious combatant country, you had a lot of government programs for, I mean, you had a Ministry of Food. We have a collection of recipes from the cookbook flyers that were circulated around from the Ministry of Food, how to make use of, you know, these sometimes unappetizing things that were what was available. And so there was a lot of that, and there tends to be a lot of that in a situation of emergency. The challenge is going to be to see how much of it goes away as soon as when the virus does.
Yeah, so do you think that as the virus dissipates, we're going to people who were sort of reluctantly wanting globalism to go away are just going to keep quiet and sort of hope? Do you think coronavirus has dealt a early death blow to the global society, the global economy, like as a connected?
Oh, yeah. Well, the global economy was already in deep trouble. One of the major axes of it was the arrangement between the United States and China, where the U.S. takes China's consumer product and we pay them in paper. And a lot of that is already collapsing with Trump's tariffs. And generally the way that he has been imposing sensible tariffs on global trade, the whole system is coming unglued because the linchpin of that system was the United States as the consumer of last resort, the country that would take anything. We're not doing that anymore. And so it was already in deep trouble. And I think the coronavirus is going to prove to be a major blow because on the one hand, we've seen what the problems are here in the United States, for example, with having much of our medical technology and gear and supplies made in China. Well, you know, the Chinese are not necessarily sending them. So there has, in fact, been an executive order issued just recently to move more of that production back to the United States. There will be more.
Yeah, I believe Musk jumped on that opportunity.
Yeah, exactly. And so there's all this stuff that all of these things that I think will be lasting changes, simply because people are looking at the situation and saying, no, we need to go. This is a downside we don't need. And I expect to see less opposition to border checks, less support for illegal immigration in the aftermath of this.
Yeah, these were the you know, increased, this is what I had written down, kind of increased distrust in sort of hegemonic, you know, EU-type government things, and a sort of a rally cry for traditionally right-wing strategies, you know. I think any smart right-leaning politician right now could find it very easy means to attune this to their aims. Extremely easy means. And I believe Dominic Cummings, I mean, I don't want to say if he's right-leaning, but I believe Johnson and Cummings will, you know, use this, and already are using this to their
advantage. I'd say, to use an American figure of speech, they'll be all over that like ugly on an ape. Yeah. This sort of thing, especially because the EU's own response to the situation was so clumsy. And so fixated on avoiding any appearance of racism is more important than people's lives.
Yeah,
and that if they had wanted to play into the hands of AfD and the other populist nationalist parties, they could not have done a better job. And it is not impossible that the entire Schengen arrangement, the open border arrangement, will not survive this.
Do you think it's brought any other key issues into sight, this other than the ones we've mentioned?
I don't know yet. Basically, a lot is going to depend on what happens with the conversations from here on, and especially as effective treatments and vaccines start hitting the big time, as I expect will happen quite soon. Especially as the pressure starts going away, what do people start talking about? At the moment, it's still very much in the reactive phase. People are just going, and freaking out a little bit, or just settling down at home or what have you. But as the pressure starts lifting, watch what they talk about. That will give you early warning of what the big trends are going to be over the next few years.
And has it revealed, or has anything happened because of it which has surprised you?
I am a little surprised that I've heard from so many people who seem to be dealing with it and using it to shake themselves awake. I'm very pleased. But the number of people who've been talking intelligently about, wow, I should have had more food stashed, or wow, this and that and the other is really crazy, or, you know, I'm really liking just spending an evening at home.
Yeah.
It's having a much more positive reaction than I ever thought it would. And so that was a surprise. The rest of it was pretty predictable.
And
especially the alternation between, oh no, it's nothing, panic,
the classic.
Yeah, on the part of governments and everything else. That's
always best to panic early. And as someone who sort of, you know, studied these things and written about these things, obviously one of the things that I've been stating that some people online have got a bit annoyed me about, which is sort of the, once again, on the prepping mentality, is people saying, well, we'll just begin to grow crops, and yeah, you can grow some crops quite quickly and easily, lettuces, tomatoes, but in terms of substantial, you know, there's a learning curve, and people always seem to forget the, should we say, the meta part of, you know, it's not as simple as just planting seeds. So would you have any sort of, you know, this isn't the end, it's part of a larger process of collapse. It's a little hurdle which might actually sort of level the West out for a little bit. But have you got any sort of practical advice for individuals right now?
Well, I would encourage all the people who say, well, we can plant crops, to try it. Because the way they'll learn that there's a learning curve is by sticking those seeds in the ground and then discovering it's not that easy. So I would encourage all of our listeners, as the in the Northern Hemisphere, as spring comes on and it's time to plant seeds, go plant some seeds. Get a book or two on gardening and start learning how to do it. You will not learn it all at once. It is not the simplest thing. You know, Michael Bloomberg, our temporary presidential candidate over here, was quoted as talking about how, you know, farming is just stupid easy. You just stick the seed in the ground and up it comes, proving that he's never tried it. and also guaranteeing his loss of the nomination, but that's another point entirely. But yeah, the thing is, this is the time to start looking at what you can do to get to be better prepared for the next crisis, because there will be a next crisis.
Mm-hmm.
We are, industrial civilization is on the downslope of its history. The next one may not be an epidemic. It may be economic trouble. It may be a war that causes supply chains to disrupt. It could be any number of things. But there will be a next crisis, and the question is, what are you going to do about it? Now that you know some of your vulnerabilities, now that you've experienced where the limits are, where the lines are, what you have and what you don't have, you actually have some really valuable information that you can use to say, okay, I need to clear out, you know, this cupboard that I have full of stuff that I never use, and I'm going to use it to put up rice, you know, bags of rice and other things that I can rotate into my food supply and keep replacing, so that I have a couple of weeks of food. At least I can make rice and beans or what have you. You know, or why don't I try doing the garden thing this spring? Mm-hmm. Give it a try. Start learning that process. Or what have you. You know, each person will have encountered and experienced different things over the course of the epidemic. And so it's a matter of, okay, what lessons are you going to draw from that? This is not an anomaly. This is actually a return to history as usual. And we will have more things like this as we go. So learn from it. Hit the ground running. Uh-huh. Draw some conclusions. Go ahead.
That's what I was going to say is, you know, not great advice, but we're telling the herd to learn from history, which is always...
Mm-hmm. Well, no, I'm not telling the herd to learn from history. I'm telling individuals to learn from history.
Yeah.
The herd will do what the herd always does. But each pair of ears listening to this podcast belongs to an individual human being. And those individuals can learn from history.
Mm-hmm.
Will they? That depends on them. But they have the capacity. It can happen. I've actually seen it with my own eyes.
Mm-hmm. Is there anything else you'd like to add?
One of the things that I think a lot of people may be surprised by, I am expecting this whole thing to end a lot sooner than the media is suggesting.
Mm-hmm.
On the one hand, there are a number of vaccines already in the testing phase. It's mm-hmm. it's a single virus. It's not that difficult. I mean, making vaccines is one of the things that our medical industry is fairly good at in the industrial world. So there are vaccines currently in test. There's also been some very promising news with an old malaria vaccine, of all things, that seems to affect this chloroquine. Seems to affect this virus very powerfully. There have been some favorable tests. There are more tests currently underway. It is quite possible that by the end of April, all of this is going to be over.
Lovely.
So now we'll see. That may not happen, but there is a very real chance that may happen, and be ready for that.
Mm-hmm.
Don't assume that this is going to go on, drag on as long as the media wants you to think.
Mm-hmm.
So beyond that, I don't know. Just I would encourage people to learn from their experience, enjoy their time off, and laugh at the vagaries of the people who are trying to spin the news one way or the other.
Okay. And I imagine this will bring quite a few new listeners to the podcast and to you. So is there anything you would like to direct them towards of yours? I mean, I would say if you're interested in Collapse, read Dark Age America and Collapse mm-hmm. Now and Avoid the Rush by John Michael Green.
Mm-hmm. Those would certainly be good places to start. And in terms, I'm not doing a lot on Collapse these days. I wrote everything I could think of to write about that back in the days of the Archdruid Report,
mm-hmm.
and I have a number of books on that subject. The Long Descent still remains, I think, a good introduction to that.
Mm-hmm.
These days, my work has been heading in other directions, but that's fine. Those who are interested in seeing where I'm going now, ecosophia.net is my blog. And, you know, my books are available at cheap bookstores everywhere.
Okay. John Michael Gray, thanks once again for coming on Hermetics.
And thank you.